Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris, and today our special guest is Rich Ford. Rich is Chief Development Officer and co-founder of Roofstock, a semi-stealth new startup based in Oakland, whose website bills the company as Rental Home Investing Made Stock Market Simple. Invitees who are starting to buy and sell on the site have called it the E-Trade of occupied rental home investing. Rich is far from a newcomer to the single-family rental market. Before Roofstock, Rich spent 20 years doing investment banking with a focus on capital raising and strategic advisory within the real estate sector in general and the emerging single-family rental industry specifically. Firms included Jefferies, Bank of America, Merrill Lynch, Lehman Brothers, and Morgan Stanley. He hosted the first ever single-family rental conference back in May 2012 and was instrumental in the formation of Invitation Homes, the largest owner of single-family residences or rentals in the U.S. today. Rich has worked with all the largest participants in the SFR sector on capital raising or advisory work, including providing expertise on most of the IPOs. He was integral to the creation of a new class of preferred security for AMH that links home price appreciation to returns. Rich also advised on the sale of over 6,000 single-family rental homes, including many of the major transactions in the market, and is a frequent moderator or panelist at single-family rental conferences. Rich, welcome back to our show.
Great. Thanks, Whoppers.
I'm curious, how many different models are there? That's one of the questions I always get from investors that are concerned. Or do they all have, okay, once price is max, we're out of here, or are some of them sort of like scattered apartments? They're going to be held for a long time in a REIT. So can you give me what kind of combination is out there and what is their end game?
That's a great question. And I do think it is a full spectrum. You've got folks like American Homes for Rent, which is down the road from you, headquartered, that was founded by Wayne Hughes and the team that built Public Storage. Mm-hmm. That I don't know if they've sold more than a handful of Public Storage facilities, as they built that massive company, and I think it will be very similar with the single family rental market. I think they'll buy and sell, you know, assets selectively, but they're going to be in this. They're a publicly traded company. They're going to be in this for the long run. So I just don't see them exiting. I think they're just continue to make their operations more and more efficient, find good buying opportunities, and grow that platform into another, you know, world-class company. And then, you know, there's the other side where there was, you know, hot money that was short-term. That
we faced a lot of that.
Yeah, totally. And I think that some of that capital, you know, is looking to exit, you know, in certain markets right now. I was involved in, you know, selling, you know, half a dozen or more bigger portfolios to, you know, to other buyers. And a lot of that was, you know, people that wanted to harvest the gains and move into other opportunities. But I will say that I don't think there's going to be this, you know, herd effect where everybody's trying to exit at the same time. I think there'll be groups that stay in this forever. I think there'll be groups that utilize the cheap leverage that's out there. I talked to a group this morning that I thought might be ready to sell this large portfolio that they'd accumulated in a Midwestern city, and they said, no, actually, we just put another three-year financing on the portfolio. It's yielding great. It's got more upside. I think the nice thing is that these are, you know, profitable, cash-flowing, good assets. And unlike, you know, when all the inventory was sitting in banks' hands and it was costing them money and it was untenanted or non-cash-flowing and they had pressures to, you know, to liquidate, I just don't see that happening this go-around. I think you'll see certain people exit. You'll have capital be replaced with new capital, and you'll have some assets being sold individually as that becomes more easy to do. So it'll change hands, but I don't think we're going to have everybody acting in one direction.
Okay, well that's safer. That's certainly a safer exit plan. You know, if it's miscellaneous endings, and that's a good thing. The properties that were purchased, what percentage of them were bought in bulk type sales?
You know, very few. Now, recently we had some big merger activity, but on the front end, when we're talking, you know, 2012 and 13 and 14, is really amazing. I mean, these companies like Invitation Homes that built up, you know, a 50,000 unit plus portfolio was almost done all one by one by having a real acquisition machine in place, buying off the courthouse steps and MLS, you know, some little small portfolio transactions, but there wasn't a lot of homes held in big pools. There's been more recently, there's been some huge transactions. So you may have probably know that, Colony and Starwood Waypoint just merged, and that was followed. Starwood and Waypoint had merged ahead of that, so that's created a very big publicly traded company. American Homes for Rent has just acquired American Residential Properties. Those were both publicly traded companies, and that transaction is happening. So those are some massive transactions, and there has been some portfolio sales. But as folks were building these companies on the front end, it was home by home, and most of them were vacant homes that they were renovating and then leasing up.
So the trustee sale process was probably one of the biggest providers, would you say?
Yes, it was a big and it moved around a little bit. There was a lot of folks buying off the courthouse steps for a long period of time, and then as they as those opportunities didn't weren't quite as attractive, they moved over to buying off the MLS and other channels. But yes, the courthouse steps really did facilitate things on the front end.
Okay. And again, that's one of the reasons why I thought, okay, as that dissipates, say in an area like California, price point higher, trustee sales down probably 90%+, it's got to be more difficult to get inventory at this point than to raise capital for the pursuit of the single family house.
Well, raising capital isn't easy for sure in the public markets. The companies went public a little early. Wall Street isn't a very patient place. So I wouldn't say that's easy to do. The debt capital has been quite plentiful and has been quite easy to access. But I will say that unlike multifamily, where it is really hard to find assets, there's always, homes through different channels that folks can purchase. And once they've gained scale in a marketplace, they don't really need to acquire at such a ferocious pace. I think there was a little bit of a race on in these individual markets to make sure that they could accumulate several hundred homes in specific regions so that it made sense from an operational standpoint. But once they have that footprint, there's always a home or two that, that pops up, every week that they can add to that. And it's very granular. So I don't think people are having a hard time, finding inventory, but definitely you're correct in that there's not this plethora of homes on, coming off the courthouse steps anymore.
Once a quarter, we see advertised bulk sale for trustees or notes from Fannie Mae. Are any of the participants in the single family rental arena kind of trying to go through that door to back end into inventory?
I don't think so. I can't speak perfectly on that. I know on the front end of this, we thought that HUD and Fannie and all these different government agencies were going to be a huge source of inventory, and we spent a lot of time, working and thinking through that. And I know from the NPL side of things that, that is the case. But I think a lot of that, of the folks that are buying, individual, single family rental homes, that's not a big, big channel. I think on the NPL side, those channels have been plentiful.
What were some of the challenges that these companies faced? Because this is sort of a brand new toy. No one really had 1,000 houses for rent all over the place. So what were some of the challenges, and do you feel like they've worked out the kinks and they have these models that are pretty efficient at this point?
I think they have incredibly efficient models on the acquisition, renovation, and leasing side of the equation currently, and that wasn't without trial and error either. A lot of companies went through a lot of different programs to kind of figure out how to get that done, but I think they've done a lot of, they've made a lot of acquisitions and taken homes to the rental side. I think still on the operating and the repair and maintenance and getting that completely fine-tuned, it's still a very young industry, and I think there's going to continually be a lot of improvements that occur there. I do think that a lot of folks maybe wish they didn't go public as early as they had, because you have all that transparency and you're kind of getting to, you know, watch the airplane getting made as it's flying, which isn't always great for your management teams to have out there. But it was a great way to access some capital early on and invest when prices were at a very low price point.
I'm not sure, honestly, though, just being honest about what I know and what I don't know. The advantage of going public was such a new concept. Was there money readily available, and that accelerated their ability to purchase? Is that what they going public would do?
Yeah, I mean, it was. I did investment banking for 20 years, as I mentioned, and it was really interesting. I've never seen a sector been able to access the public market so early. There was a few blind pool deals done, but they were really, it was for capital in an established sector. And normally when you take a company public, you've got several years of operating history, you're raising capital that's generally going to pay down debt, and then the company makes acquisitions and relevers up. You know, this is a really unique situation where a lot of folks recognize that the purchasing opportunity was so great that they should take the risk that, you know, the capital markets would be patient enough to let the operations be built as things were going on. So myself and several other investment bankers, I mean, we were pretty successful in going out and explaining how great the acquisition opportunity was. But, you know, Wall Street's a tricky place, and I would say, you know, it's been very challenging for the public companies, again, just on the equity side, not on the debt side, you know, to be doing all of this in their, you know, in their inception. And most of these companies were a year or less old when they went out and accessed public capital, which is pretty unusual.
When you say public capital and then put the term blind pool with it, that means that please give us your money and we're going to let you know what we do with it in a little while?
That's right. That's right. A lot of times, you know, I've worked on transactions in the past where, you know, the properties had been identified, they were ready to be closed. Now, these were, you know, big office buildings or apartment buildings or what have you. So
Right. You
were going out to raise the capital or debt financing had been put on them, and you were going to bring it down to a more moderate level. But, you know, here it was so fragmented that folks could go out and, you know, explain what the properties were that they were going to buy, what they looked like. But yeah, it was raising a bunch of capital to go execute a business plan. And that's not always, you know, that's not always the well done in the, you know, in the public eye. So I think the companies that did it, are going to do fine. And we've seen some consolidation and their operations are getting better and better. The equity markets haven't been as patient, you know, allow them to do that in the time that it normally takes. So it's been a little choppy out there for them. But on the flip side, they've all been able to access debt at very attractive rates, and the debt markets have embraced the sector. They understand what hard real estate assets are. They understand cash flow and have actually, you know, helped these companies continue to grow by being able to access debt.
Are they concerned about another big downturn? There's always somebody saying there'll be a crash in the real estate market. I'm interviewing Harry Dent on Monday, so he'll be one of them. So with this model, are they concerned about timing of a market in the sense that if they really thought a downturn was coming, they would want to be out, or they would be looking at that as a buying opportunity to get even more?
Yeah, I don't think the guys that are in the public markets are maybe planning to somehow access capital or merge or what have you. I don't think they're really overly concerned about the stocks getting hit any harder, because they've been hit pretty hard. There's a concept called NAV, or net asset value, that is looked at for a lot of the REIT companies, and it's not that hard to value these companies. You can pretty much determine what these homes are worth. It's a lot of homes, but you can figure it out, and you can figure out what the debt is on the companies. And most of them are already trading on the single-family rental side at pretty massive discounts to net asset value. So I think a lot of people feel it's pretty hard for these things to get hit any harder. Now, that's very different than a lot of the other public REITs in office and retail and multifamily land, you know, that have been trading fairly well over the last few years. So I think that they would like for their stock prices to get better so they could potentially access that capital, but I don't think they're overly worried about you know, about a further impact to their stock prices. I think they're more worried about just getting the word out there and getting an institutional following that embraces the sector.
How do these types of companies make decisions? I got involved a little bit about, you know, when I was debating people in the building industry, courtesy of John Burns. So I got a little bit of insight how they operated and who they listened to. So who does this group of people, who do they listen to say you should go here or go there, or they do that internally?
Well, there's the groups that are public, you know, do have very vocal investors. They have research analysts that cover them. They have boards of directors. So they've got a lot of different parties that they are listening to. And, you know, part of the problem, you know, with the public, you know, Wall Street model is it's pretty short-term focused. So they've got to balance out, you know, those shorter-term stock price and performance goals with their longer-term strategies, and that's a challenge. A lot of the other private groups, and again, we have big public equity firms behind some groups. We have high net worth families behind some groups. You know, a lot of them are, you know, have, you know, real visionaries and leaders there and you know, aren't necessarily as focused on, you know, the shorter immediate term consequences and really have a longer term view. Some of them have debt that they have to think about refinancing at different times, so that will influence their decision somewhat. But there's definitely a lot of voices at the table. We've got management teams that have to balance quite a bit in the sector.
Are there some areas where accumulation of properties has literally stopped?
You know, I think for the bigger players, there's certain markets where they're not as active, and that's the markets that where prices have improved a lot, and they accumulated a fair number of homes, so they feel that they've got a really good footprint in that market, and we've seen that a little bit in California and markets like Phoenix. A lot of the capital started out west and then moved to groups, you know, places like Atlanta and other areas. So there's definitely less investment dollars as a percentage of what they're putting out going into those markets that have appreciated the most and where they gained the biggest footprint.
The biggest areas of accumulation right now then are where?
I think Florida is a very active market. Atlanta is a big market with a lot of different participants in it. The Texas markets have been very active. And then, you know, more recently over the last year or so, there is a lot of folks looking very heavily at the Midwest, Indianapolis and Denver, and you're starting to see more and more activity in those types of markets.
Do they ever go to an area that would be driven, let's say like a Houston that's kind of driven by an oil-based economy? Do they go to that one, I don't know, one-note town, or do they stay away from that type of thing generally?
I think folks have the bigger players have enough diversity between markets so that, you know, they're underwriting the risk return aspect of each market. And Houston's an interesting one. You know, maybe we end up in a spot here where it's a good jumping in point again. I do think though the other thing to be really mindful of is this is, you know, we don't want to overly emphasize the big players here because they really are only a very small percentage of the market. And so you have a lot of local groups that just have really great knowledge and are very comfortable with that marketplace. And so if you went into any one market like Austin or Houston or what have you, you'd find a lot of players that own several hundred homes that, you know, really know what they're doing in that market.
When an investor goes to sell homes, and I've just gone through this, I mean, I literally put out notices, okay, time to go. So my cash flow ended the month I suggested that. And the logical person to purchase it was going to be an owner-occupant, which was true 100% of the time in the inventory that I've just gone through. So that's kind of what goes on. Is that you exit your properties, you do the repairs, and you sell it to an owner occupant, and maybe 3 or 6 months have elapsed. And so a little bit of what, you know, you're doing with your new company is trying to change the way properties are marketed. Can we talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, definitely. That's exactly right. I mean, when I was doing investment banking, there was really only two ways to sell these rental homes was one in a giant pooled transaction. And that was always a little daunting. You try to sell 1,000 homes. There's only so many groups that can write that check. They generally don't want exactly the same geographic location or price point or type of home. But it was really hard to break that up. The other way was exactly what you're describing, is someone would, you know, wait for the lease to expire, which could be, you know, 1 to 12 months from now, and then have to spruce up the property, and then go out and conduct a regular way sales process and trying to sell to an owner-occupant. And the friction costs in that are pretty significant. It's, you know, you're going to pay 5 or 6% commission for one, but on top of that, losing 3 to 4 months rent, carrying taxes, paying insurance, utilities, and the money that went into paint and spruce it up a little bit, there's, you know, about a 10% load, in many cases actually even more. So that's exactly what we're trying to solve. There's, you know, 15 million rental homes, there's 4 million owners, there's 1 million transactions a year, and it really shouldn't just be those two options. In one case with a group that I worked with in Phoenix and Vegas, they sold a lot of homes that way that you just mentioned, and found out that a certain percentage of those were being bought by investors who were turning around and putting a tenant back in it.
Right.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's incredibly inefficient. Yeah, that's at Roofstock, that's exactly the problem we're trying to solve. I mean, we've embarked on a way to sell the homes with a tenant in place, so that they're cash flowing, very credible, it doesn't disrupt the tenant, and allows an investor to turn around and just that cash flow gets switched over from you to the new buyer, you know, at the execution of the document, and reduce those friction costs to a fraction of what they were. And so we're changing the way things are going to be done a little bit here, but we think there's a big market for it. And it doesn't mean that every home will get sold that way. There's definitely some cases where that owner-occupant buyer will be better, and there's some cases where a pooled transaction makes sense. But there's going to be a lot of transactions where that should make sense.
We've only got a couple minutes left, so I'm going to bring up four topics. You choose whichever one you want to address. Is there going to be available financing? Is the management somehow going to be suggested repairs, and also the ability to exchange 1031 exchange into inventory?
Well, yeah, let's start with the 1031 exchange, because I think that's extremely interesting when you look at what's happened with multifamily in particular. For those folks listening, a 1031 exchange is an excellent opportunity for folks to sell real estate and transfer the tax basis from that real estate over to new real estate that they purchase. The big issue, Bruce, as you know, is trying to do that in the time constraints that you're given and have it all work. So you've really got to have your ducks in a row for that to happen.
Yeah, I've got 45 days to nominate a property. So the odds of that being out of my area are pretty remote, because that's a lot to ask. And your website is going to help solve that.
Yeah, and normally most people are, you know, very familiar with one or two asset classes, and they're exchanging from one apartment building over to another apartment building. I think what's going to be really interesting, particularly with what we're trying to do, is, you know, is to be able to, for people to think about exchanging out of multifamily into single family rental. And you know, what we set out to do is have all of this online in such a way that it's a, you know, click of a mouse purchasing and a really short closing period, so that the assets can be underwritten, identified, and then closed on in a very short manner. And yes, it's granular, but being able to do it very quickly with a big group of assets and with property managers that have been certified in different markets, hopefully will help folks that decide that multifamily's had its run and now they'd like to deploy capital into an asset class that, you know, has more upside and good cash flows.
Rich, we're out of time. Thanks for joining us. Rich Ford from Roofstock, and we will be talking to him further as that site becomes more readily available to more and more people. So, Rich, thanks for joining us. Really appreciate it.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.